So I just think that, that because we're in a formal meeting, I don't think this is acceptable compiling of the documentation. So please, can we make sure that doesn't happen again?
Yeah, the other thing as well is that they're all classified as rules.
Yeah.
They're not distinguished as by year rules, by just school rules. So it is rather confusing when you've got the document. It's just all classified as rules.
Yeah. I just printed them, then I thought maybe I was trying to identify the
We'll just tag them and we'll just give members a new index so that they're not reviewing. Okay, Ms. Hartley, are you ready to proceed? What's number five? Ms. Hartley's document is the 05. Mark the 05. It just says rules 05. It's the one that says rules for procedure. This document. Everybody got it?
I'll just go into the background of the importance of the promotion of access to information laws and the importance of these rules. The access to relevant information is fundamental to meaningful participation in the democratic process and to ensure that government is accountable to the government. Section 32 of the final constitution states that everyone has the right of access to any information that is held by the state, and any information that is held by another person and that is required for the exercise or protection of any rights. And subsection 2 of section 32 says that legislation must be enacted to give effect to this right and may provide for reasonable measures to alleviate the administrative and financial burden on the state. The Promotion of Access to Information Act 2 of 2000, which I shall refer to as PIA, is the national legislation which was enacted to give effect to the constitutional right of access to information. PIA came into operation on 9 March 2001. Section 79.1 of PIA provides that the rules board must, within 4 years after the commencement of Section 79, make rules of procedure for a court in respect of applications in terms of Section 78, and a court to receive representations ex parte, refers to in Section 8238 of PIA. Section 78 of PIA provides that an unsuccessful or aggrieved requester may apply to court for appropriate relief in terms of Section 82 of PIA. Section 83 provides that any court hearing an application may receive representations ex parte, conduct hearings in camera, and prohibit the publication of such information in relation to the proceedings as the court determines, including information in relation to the parties to the proceedings and the contents of orders made by the court in the proceedings. Now, until the rules are enacted or passed, the applications in terms of PIA can only be heard in the High Court. So it is important that these rules are passed in order that applications can also be brought in the magistrate's court, which will make it easier for applicants and make it easier for them to have access to these rules. The rules themselves, the rules board has drafted a set of rules which the form to the rules are intended to be simple so that applicants can fill in the form themselves, even unrepresented applicants, and make the applications to court themselves without requiring an attorney if necessary. Should I go through the provisions of the rules? Rule 2.1 states that the procedure prescribed in the PIA rule shall be followed in all applications contemplated in Section 78 of PIA. Section 79.2 of PIA states that until the PIA rules come into operation, an application in terms of Section 78 must be lodged with a high court or another court having jurisdiction. After the PIA rules come into operation, applications may also be brought in the magistrate court. Rule 2.2 provides that these rules are to be supplemented by the rules of the court in which the application is brought, where necessary. Rule 3.1 provides that the application is to be brought on notice of motion to certify an affidavit. A form for the notice of motion is prescribed in the annexure. Rule 338 is out the information which the affidavit should contain. Rule 338B2 states that the affidavit should state whether the internal appeal procedure contemplated in Section 74 of CAIA has been exhausted, and if not, why not? Section 74 provides that a requester or third party may lodge an internal appeal against the decision of the information officer of a public body. Section 78 of PAIA provides that a requester or third party may only apply to court for relief after the requester or third party has exhausted the internal appeal procedure. The rules court considered this but decided to insert this requirement as it was felt that the court had inherent jurisdiction to condone non-compliance with this requirement, for example, in cases of urgency. Rule 33B3 states that the affidavit should explain the relevance of each document upon which the applicant intends to rely. Although Section 18 of PAIS does not require the requester of a record from a public body to explain the relevance of the required record, Section 53.2D requires the requester of a record from a private body to provide an explanation of why the requested record is required. Rule 3.4 provides that the information officer or head of a private body must notify all affected parties of the application and file two copies of the request and a notification of the decision which is sent to the requester with the clerk of the court or the registrar. It also provides that the information officer or head of a private body must inform the applicant that copies of the request and the decision have been filed with the clerk of the court or registrar. If the reasons for the decision have not yet been provided to the applicant, they must be served on the applicant. Rule 3.5 provides that where the information officer or head of a private body fails to comply with Rule 3.4, the applicant may request that the clerk of the court or registrar place the application before the court for an order in terms of Section H2B of PAIA, which provides that the court may grant an order requiring the information officer or relevant authority of a public body or the head of a private body to take such action or to refrain from taking such action as the court considers necessary within a period mentioned in the order. Approval of rules and submission to Parliament. On 13 September 2007, the prior rules which had been approved by the Rules Board were submitted to the Minister for approval as required by Section 6.1 of the Rules Board Act. Section 79.3 of the prior Act provides that any rule made in terms of Section 79.1 must be for publication in the Gazette be approved by Parliament.
Just in your document, you refer to Rule 3 sub 3A. I don't know about this, but I don't have a 3 sub 3A. I need 3 sub 4A. Because 3 doesn't have an A in it.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I think my 3 sub 4A. Yeah, check that. Okay.
So I'm going to bring it to the group.
Okay, I don't know if members want to ask questions now or whether we should take the briefing from the submission from ODAC and then open it up to how would members feel? Questions at this stage?
Sorry, what is the answer to your question?
That it is in fact 3 sub 4, because if you look at the rules board, they refer to 3
yeah.
But there isn't.
Okay,
there
yeah.
isn't.
I just wanted to make sure that
three
they
four.
Are, have got the right rules.
Yes, 3 4.
Okay. Then, if there are no questions at this stage, I think over to Alison. Members will note that we received 3 submissions. We received a submission from, 4 submissions. It's from SAHA, the Human Rights Commission, and ODAC, but only ODAC requested the opportunity to make an oral submission. So, welcome, Alison.
Thank you very much.
You're glad the day has arrived.
I'm very, very pleased the day has arrived. If I can take you to your document number 11. 08 rules 11. One of the reasons that we're very pleased to be making the submission is because it relates to the extension of the jurisdiction of the court to consider access to information issues. It is obviously not a first prize for us. First prize is the creation of an information commission. And some of the practical difficulties, which I will try to explain that the rules do not address, would be more easily dealt with in an information commission. A magistrate's court is still a court, even though one that is cheaper and more accessible than the Supreme Court, like the High Court. I might point out that we at the moment have a matter which has gone from the High Court in Johannesburg to the Supreme Court of Appeal and on to a set of referees who have yet to meet to look at the records, and it's 5 years later. And our clients at this point may not survive. Our client is an NGO, not a living person. Our client may not survive to actually see the records released. So that is an example of the difficulties of being in the Supreme Court. I think that one of the things that we've discovered in litigating around the Access to Information Act is that the most difficult issue for judges, really, is the question of them looking at a document that one person in the courtroom does not see. It feels wrong for judges. They are used to a situation in which they get the record only once both parties have seen it. So if something is going to come to court, it has to be served on the other side. And they then act in our system as a referee. They sit back, they hear arguments from both sides in relation to everything that is in front of them. This is something that is, by its nature, quite different. This is something where you actually cannot let the applicant look at the records, some of the records, because the argument is precisely that the records have to be kept confidential. Now, the way the courts have dealt with this so far has been quite simply to try and resolve the matter without looking at the records. So if you look at all of the case law, the way the judges have dealt with it is not to look at the record, but rather to try and work out if there's an inherent flaw in the arguments of one side or the other. So they'll say to the Auditor General in the C-squared, I-squared matter, you are trying to argue both that there are too many records for you to look at, and you are trying to argue that there's a national security issue. You can't have looked at the records to determine that there's a national security issue because you say there are too many of them. We don't think there are too many of them. Therefore, we're going to release the records. Or alternatively, looking at the nature of the document. Well, this is a report. It's a report about the traditional succession issues in the area in Sekekuni land. This report has been outstanding for some time. It doesn't seem as though there's anything that's going to change or be different because of this report being released. Therefore, the exemption that's being claimed is that it is in fact an ongoing process. It's not correct on the argument that's been put to us, and therefore we want the document to be released. So that's the way the courts have argued it thus far. And when we have come in front of the Supreme Court of Appeal and asked them to look at the records, they have said, not only will we not look at these records, but we don't feel we have the technical capacity to actually determine whether or not there are confidential matters in these records, because we are not physicists. You could show us the first year physics textbook, and you could show us nuclear secrets, and frankly, we would not be able to tell the difference. So we are going to need somebody to help us make this decision. So this is the context in which these rules come to us. We also must bear in mind that the magistrates must have rules made for them. They don't have an inherent jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has inherent jurisdiction and can make its own rules as it goes along. Now, even the Supreme Court, with its inherent jurisdiction, has found it very difficult to work out how precisely it is going to look at the record concerned. What we are concerned about, the key issue for us in these rules, is how does the Magistrates' Court look at these rules? And we are of the view that the rules are not going to meet the purpose for which they are required. We have looked at some other jurisdictions with the assistance of our researcher here, Christopher Reeves, and we've also looked at what happens in what has happened in previous South African cases. And it seems to us that there are that the model that's really adopted by most jurisdictions is that there is a process set up whereby the document which is disputed, the document that allegedly contains the confidential information, is handed to the presiding officer, and the presiding officer will then read the document and then make a decision. Now, that sounds fairly simple, but that part of the process is not really set out in the law. So the question is going to be, when you produce the documents, how do you give them to the magistrate? Now, you know, you guys have probably been down to one or other of the courts recently. It is simply not possible to take a set of documents that contain highly confidential information. And I'm not just talking about state secrets, I'm talking about research, commercial secrets. You simply can't take them down to the magistrate's court and hand them over to the clerk of the court. I mean, it's simply not going to be possible. The magistrate's courts are going to need some set of procedures whereby the documents are handed to the magistrate in a sealed way, in a way that the magistrate then is responsible for keeping them confidential. The problem arises then what to do for the parties in court. The notion of the index, it's intended, and that has been the rule since C²I² was decided, is that you should have what is called a Vaughan index in when you are refused information, which should list the record, it should explain what the annexures are, and it should explain why the record is being refused. Now, this happens in our experience. In fact, it's only happened once when a respondent has actually understood what it is that they are required to do in the creation of an index. And even then, they have not, in fact, described the documents that they are refusing. They've simply explained the detailed reason for the refusal, which is why we suggest that there would need to be the creation of an index, which is, in fact, served on the other side and handed up to the magistrate, which explains, sets out in detail what records are being dealt with and explained why in each case the respondent refuses them. There are rare instances, and they are very rare, where just acknowledging the existence of the document is in fact a problem. So if you say, can I have the nuclear submarine program for the state of Mauritius, and Mauritius is forced to reply that we may not have the document because it is secret, well, then I know that there are documents that relate to the nuclear program in the state of Mauritius, and bingo, I have the answer to my question. So that is the type of instance where you are, for example, you are asking about whether or not there are covert operatives working in a particular area. There are certain questions that cannot be answered without giving away the information. Now, how that is to be dealt with here is not clear, but that we flag that as a matter which, you know, we think does need to be dealt with. Once you have a process in place where you have decided that how you're going to deal with it is an in-camera approach, you would then have a sealed record which goes to the magistrate, the index goes to the other party. You can then have a hearing in front of the magistrate where the magistrate would hear arguments from the applicant and the respondent. The magistrate, in terms of the current rules, does not have the ability to excuse a party from the room. If I'm going to have an in-camera hearing, I have the applicant and respondent in the room, but nobody else. I can have that kind of hearing. There's precedent for that in South Africa. There is no precedent for the situation where I send the applicant out of the room and only the respondent stays and only the respondent makes arguments about the documents which have been sealed and which have not obviously been shown to the applicant. How the magistrate is going to do that with the set of rules, it is not clear to me. It seems to me that the magistrate at that point is going to be either making it up in sending, and I mean, you know, magistrates may have to do that, and they have to send the party out of the room. But I'm not sure in terms of what the magistrate would be empowered to do that. And again, coming back to the question that the magistrate is creature statute, no inherent jurisdiction, unable to make up their own rules in this regard. So I think that's the sort of second part of the problem. The third part is really the question of judgment. Now, when you're going to make a judgment in this type of matter, you're going to want to make something to give an indication to the parties why you are refusing the record. It may be necessary to exclude some of the information, and it may be necessary to say very simply that the record is refused. If you get into the detail of why the record is being refused, you may then show the confidential information. So what is possible is where you have two different versions. Certainly in the referee, if you look at the referee approach in 19 of the Supreme Court Act, which is another model we looked at, what you can do is you can have a document which is sent only to the court. So the referee looks at the documents, they make a report on whether or not technically this is in fact a first year textbook, or in fact it is a nuclear secret. And then they don't give that to the party on the other side, they give it to the court, which then makes the ruling. And then the parties can't necessarily have access to all parts of that report. So that's also a... so that the question of judgment itself, the order itself, is not straightforward, because the order itself may have to contain information that is confidential. As I said, we've focused on the option of really looking at an ex parte in camera hearing, where you would have a hearing with the applicant, the respondent, and then the applicant would be excused for part of the hearing. It is true that there would be these situations where you can need technical assistance. We have looked at the option where you would actually refer it to a referee who refers it back again. But the difficulty with that is simply that the cost of the referee then has to be borne by the parties. And that obviously immediately puts it outside of people's ability to pay. Whereas if the magistrate is sitting with an assessor who is a technical expert, that cost is then borne by the court and would not then be borne by the party. So you would then be in a position where you would have an expert who would assist the magistrate to coming to a conclusion, but that assistance is not an expense which is to be paid by the parties, which obviously would then create difficulties in and of itself in terms of access. I think those are the main issues that we wanted to highlight. If you'll give me a minute just to review our documentation. The other question is, having devolved jurisdiction to the magistrate's court, it is now not clear to me whether you can proceed in the Supreme Court. And if you chose to proceed in the Supreme Court, whether you would only be able to claim costs on a magistrate's court tariff. Now, it may be so that you would want all matters dealt with by the magistrate's court as a court of first instance. It has been put to me that there are cases, particularly involving complex national security issues, where you may want to go to the Supreme Court as a court of first instance. But obviously the applicant would not want to do that if they're only going to be awarded their costs on a magistrate's court tariff. So this is another issue which it does not seem clear to me is resolved in terms of the rules as they've been put before us. I'd like to just come back to a point made by Ms. Hartley in relation to the rule which talks about the affidavit made by the applicant. It says that the affidavit must explain, if you look at Rule 4C, the affidavit referred to in Sub Rule 3 must explain the relevance of each document upon which the applicant tends to rely. Now, I understand from that, and I didn't understand it before Ms. Hartley, I think, made it clear in her presentation, that what that tries to talk to is that in the question of requesting records that are held by a private body, you have to explain why you need the record. You can't just come and say, look, you hold a record, I want to see the record, that's the end of the story. You have to come and say, I need this record for the exercise or protection of my rights. So you have to then set out why you need that record, and that is a big hurdle. That is a big hurdle in terms of the cases that have been heard so far on that matter. There are three cases that we're aware of that have dealt with privately held information, and in none of those cases has the applicant cleared that hurdle. So it's a significant hurdle to clear. And obviously, in a request for records privately held, it's a very important matter and must be dealt with at length. However, by contrast, in requests for publicly held records, the Act, in fact, doesn't only say that you don't need to give a reason. It says you specifically can't be asked to give a reason. And the intention behind that is that you don't want, when you're faced with a request for information, you don't want the official saying, but why do you want this record? And unfortunately, a lot of officials do say that. The idea is that either the document is a public document and must be disclosed, or it is not a public document and it must not be disclosed. There is no inquiry into the intention of the requester. Now, this formulation seems to fall between the two stools. It does not adequately deal with the reasons that you need to set out if the matter is one relating to a privately held record. And if you are looking at a publicly held record, it goes too far, because then it says that you must explain the relevance of the documents on which you intend to request, I think is the word, not necessarily rely, but explain the relevance of the documents. And of course, the Act specifically enjoins you from doing that. So I think that is a difficulty in terms of that formulation, which would need to be addressed. I think those are the main submissions. I'd say that the ESCOM have a good point, and we would endorse their concerns in relation to that issue, and of course endorse the position of the South African Human Rights Commission in relation to the creation of a separate information commissioner. I can't restrain myself from telling you that the South African Law Reform Commission has finally, very nearly, managed to complete the legislation that would deal with data protection and would, as a necessary consequence of the data protection legislation, create an information regulator. The information regulator, it is proposed, would deal with information. The matter has become one of interesting urgency because of the Football World Cup. I don't know if this is the matter that has reached you, but the whole question of advanced passenger information and the ability of Home Affairs to process the necessary visas apparently rests on the data protection legislation being in place. So that is another burning reason as to why the Information Commission legislation, if it is to take the shape of the data protection legislation with an associated regulator, it's a very important issue, and one that we certainly hope to see prioritized and dealt with. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thanks, Alison. Just to say, we raised the issue, obviously, of the Information Commissioner when we met with you the last time. We gave an undertaking that we would raise it with the department, and we did. And it's good that Mr. Redman is here, because you actually provided me with the document on the Information Commissioner.
and that you were waiting, if I recall, as Alison has said, waiting for the Law Commission to deal with the grant of protection, but maybe just to explain to everybody where we are on that issue.
Well, Chair, there is an investigation by the South African Law Reform Commission, Privacy and Data Protection, and part of that investigation includes the possibility of setting up such a structure, such an office. We haven't received the report yet. I believe it's in the final stages, and we should receive it towards the end of this year or early next year. Then the executive will obviously have to then consider that recommendation.
The work in progress. Alison, can I just ask you, if you look at the Human Rights Commission submission, they make the point that they say the processes in the new rules will be significantly more cumbersome than the number is 12, the Human Rights Commission submission. The processes determined by the new proposed rules will be significantly more cumbersome for all parties. On an approximation of the time spent in litigation, the parties will have to spend approximately 45 further working days just to initiate the legislation. And this drags out the process. I just would you agree that the process would be more cumbersome?
Well, the question is, will cumbersome in comparison to what? If it isn't, if the question is it more cumbersome in comparison to the current process in the High Court? I would think it might be simply, it's difficult to say overall, because it might be slower to get going, but the thing is you might get a date sooner, so you might resolve it. So it may be a sort of swings and roundabout situation. Either process compared to an information commissioner is you know, ridiculously cumbersome, where you could have a much simpler process set out. So I would say, the difficulty is simply that we are introducing a measure to which, while it will go some way, I think a good set of magistrates' court rules would make it easier. But I'm not sure that these are a good set of magistrates' court rules, and that there are a number of issues that they don't deal with. And I think that magistrates, as creatures of statute, will find very difficult to work their way around.
Question to members? I think to Alison, and then I'll give Ms. Hardy a chance to respond to some of the issues you raised. JJ? Maybe just back to Ms. Hardy. Just after listening to what ODAC is saying, my worry then is if one argues that your magistrate's court do not have the rules and that they are creatures of statute and they don't have inherent jurisdiction, then surely, I don't know if I'm correct, but then every time they hear a matter such as this, would you not run into the risk of whatever they do could be viewed as being ultra vires? And that you could challenge whatever a magistrate then does because there are no rules for a magistrate that guides a magistrate? Or am I being too mean and gloomy?
Well, the rules are supplemented by the rules of the court in which the application is brought. So, for example, where there is a problem, I don't think that the rules have to be so specific. And I think the way the rules have been drawn at the moment would be sufficient for the magistrates to attend to these matters. And in regard to the matter of assessors, rule 2 of the rules provides that the rules are to be supplemented by the rules of the court and also by the Magistrates Court Act. And therefore, there is provision. There was a submission made to us to include a rule in regard to assessors, especially because of the, where there's very technical issues, where the magistrate might need assistance. But there also, the magistrate could make use of assessors because there is provision in the Magistrates Court Act for assessors that could be used to help the magistrates in a very technical matter. You could ask for experts to assist them.
I'm convinced that how many of us feel that JJ, any views?
Not on this. What I'm quite interested in on is hearing the rules board's response to ODAC's concerns, because I mean, from the report that was given earlier, you know, ODAC's been part of the process, made representations to you in the 19th of January 2005. So presumably, so presumably, what Alison has said now, you've heard before. And I wanted to know what your response to that is.
In 2004, ODAC made representations to the Rules Court, specifically in regard to that CEFA matter. And the Rules Court researchers researched the matter and found that we could not include a rule in regard to CEFA because it should have been included in the Act. It could not be put into the rule. And we responded to ODAC about that. This representation, which is now here, was only received by me on Monday morning, yesterday. So the Rules Board has not had a chance to have a look at this. They would need to have a chance to consider this and respond. It hasn't been given to them in time for them to respond.
I mean, well, obviously then to hear from ODAC why you know these representations that you're making now, did you make them before to the Rules Board? And if not, why not? I mean, were the rules changed from the earlier draft that you commented on?
I'm just trying to remember the sequence of events. It's certainly that we have seen an earlier set of rules and have made submissions in relation to them. This set of rules we have seen, certainly this set of rules we asked to see these once the advert went into the newspaper, and we saw the rules, and they seem to be the same rules that had been published in 2007. And we had last been asked to make comment. It is about 3 years ago now. So we were not, I'm not aware of us being asked to comment on these or subsequent to that.
Yeah, but I don't know if anybody, I mean, the Rules 05 sort of on page 1 and 2 sets out some form of a process. And that was that there was a draft in 2005, January. Now, I don't know how different the draft we've got before us is to that. And that draft was provisions reference made to ODAC commenting on.
Which document are we looking at?
I said Rules 05. Okay. This is the Rules for documents in this year. So basically, you know, the problem is this thing has been going on for much too long. I mean, if you look at paragraph 2 of this submission. But there was a draft that we're told you commented on in 2005.
Yes.
How different is the draft we've got before us from that draft? And even if it is somewhat different, because, I mean, there's reference anyway to it being changed, the issues that ODAC is concerned about, were they in that document, in that earlier version? I mean, the bottom line I'm trying to find out, I mean, as you can sort of obviously see, is why are you talking to each other? Is ODAC being consistent, or is it sort of coming up with things on the trot, as it were?
The thing is,
let me finish. Is it, if it is being consistent, then what has been the rule board or the department's or both's response?
I think that we have been in a position where our understanding is that these rules after 2005 have been stuck in a dispute between the Department of Justice and the Rules Board. And there hasn't been the opportunity for civil society to make comments or intervene then in the process subsequent to that. It would be nice if we were given an opportunity to make representations engage.
You're not answering the question.
Yes.
The question, look,
my mind, it's fair to give the public one chance. When it comes to departmental input, one chance.
Okay.
The draft rules are published, and you're allowed to comment on them, or you're given the opportunity to comment on them, which you were. Okay, and then, it, to my mind, it would seem fair to then produce a set of rules after hearing those comments. But why it takes 2 or 3 years to produce those rules, I don't know. That's something else that, that the Department of the Rules will need to respond to. But the question I'm asking is the points, I mean, as to both ODAC and the Rules Board, the points that ODAC is concerned about, were they in the 2005 draft? So I'm not worried about what came later. Were they in the draft or not?
No.
I suppose that's the first hurdle. Alison then says no. I don't know what. I don't know if we've got a copy of that. I don't know from the Rules Board side.
Now, I think basically in 2005, after the Rules Board had considered ODAC's representation, the Rules Board then submitted rules in early 2005 to the Minister. Then there were some representations received from the department, and the rules were drafted and NASDA redrafted the rules. But there wasn't basically much difference in the rules. But the comments that ODAC has made about these more omissions that the ODAC feels should be added to the rules, and they were definitely not in the first draft either. And I would also like to point out that in about March this year, after the Rules Board had redrafted the rules, there was a request from ODAC for a copy of the latest rule, which I then sent to them. So they have had time to consider this new set of rules.
Maybe just to take that
right
of first further, if these issues are issues that rules board...
Sorry, that was in March when?
March, I think she said.
March
of this year.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, look, be fair. I mean, the Minister approved the rules. When did the Minister approve the rules?
February, I think.
February. So the Minister already approved the rules.
Yeah.
So there was no point in nothing could really be gained by those representations. So that really is a non-response. I mean, can't be taken seriously. But you know, the Chair, the difficulty is that, I mean, I don't know what our powers are.
No, I've checked that.
We can accept or reject. Okay.
Or, and then at best, we can approve, raise these issues in the report, and ask the Rules Board to reconsider the comments made and then report back to the committee via the Minister in 6 months' time. That is the basis.
I think, and I presume everybody would agree that we should adopt the rules. That bad rules are, if they are bad, are better than no rules. I presume, and I ask that to ODAC. I mean, what are you wanting us to do? Reject the rules, or given that we can't amend them?
I think we would agree given the time frames, if the review is done quickly enough, just thinking practically. You know, they're not going to be a lot of matters. They're going to be in front of a magistrate if the rules can be reviewed in the next 4 or 5 months. There are very few matters that it would, because it probably will take 6 to 9 months to get in front of a magistrate. So even if these are signed off and promulgated and then people issue proceedings immediately, it would only affect the beginning of the process, and with any luck, one could then review the rules. Because the main difficulty seems to be the point at which you're actually in front of the magistrate, which would be the end of the process, not the beginning.
But, Chair, I mean, I think that, I mean, my first question of what were the rules, what were the rules, the earlier draft of the rules, what were the differences, did ODAC make use of the opportunity that they had? I don't think that's been answered. Alison is saying that they were not there. The Rules Board is saying that they were there. I think we can only judge on that if we see all the documentation. But obviously, so I don't think much is going to hang on that. I really don't know why this process has to take... I mean, it's Rules Board first approved it in February 2002. I mean, six and a half years. I mean, really. Now there might be, and that's not just at the Rules Board. That's at everybody. Well, I suppose particularly Rules Board and Ministry and Department. But I don't know why the Rules Board, as the body approving these, could not have kept stakeholders informed. And I think to come and say that, okay, no, we gave a copy to ODAC, a major stakeholder, in March, and expect us to be then happy that you're consulting, is really, I won't put adjectives on it, but really, once as the minister approved it, there was absolutely no value in that. There was no opportunity then for ODAC or any of civil society to make an input. So I think that it's really of concern. What's gone on here is of concern. I mean, to my mind, we've really got no choice but to adopt the rules. And I think there generally seems to be consensus that that's what we should do. But I think we should have a fairly strongly worded report, which is sort of quite critical of the amount of time this has taken, this process has taken, the fact that interested parties could not be brought on board, and I don't understand why they couldn't have been. And the fact that I think these concerns need to be urgently looked at by the Minister and the Rules Board. I'm not sure which one it would be, or both. It would be Rules Board. But I really just think it's. I mean, look, it's not one person that's at fault, but this is really not very good.
And just to follow up on that, when we extended the deadline for these rules in the judicial matters vote a month ago, we did in fact say that the delay has been completely and utterly unacceptable. You can't have a piece of legislation that flows from that is really a constitutional imperative and then have rules, both Panya and Pacha, for outstanding for as long as they have been. So that being the first point. The second point is the point that JJ made, but to say that if the golden rule is you consult before you table, because to consult after you table really is nonsensical. And the third point really I think to make is if you look at the submissions that have come in, the point also that ESCOM makes about the internal appeal process, that these rules are not really, if you try to be diplomatic, not the best set of rules I think that we could have had on the table. But given the delay and given the importance that we do have some rules on the table, I would think that the committee should approve it, but that we then give, I don't know how other members feel, maybe I think 6 months for the new committee to then liaise with the Rules Board and for the Rules Board to come back and report firstly to the portfolio committee on what it is that they're doing. And that we just keep tabs on that on the side of the committee, that it doesn't fall through the cracks and it doesn't take another 2 or 3 or 4 years to do. So now if members would agree.
No, I'd agree.
Perhaps if I could just add something that, in terms of these regulations and other regulations involving access to information, we are only one of the stakeholders involved in it. I think one of the other key stakeholders is the Human Rights Commission. And we have on a number of occasions made efforts to intervene around regulatory processes. It's very difficult. It's proved very difficult for the Human Rights Commission, as a Chapter 9 institution, to intervene in these regulatory processes. And perhaps I could throw the question back at you as the Justice Committee, in that we have been asking, and the previous chair of the Justice Committee said that there would be a review of the operations of the Access to Information Act, which has been plagued by many challenges. And that review is something that has been discussed over a number of years now. Certainly, as a collective effort in order to make sure of the proper functioning of the Act, there are a number of players involved. And I would suggest that certainly in terms of the review of the functioning of PIA, which is something that the Justice Committee has previously discussed. That would be a very useful initiative, not something that perhaps can be taken up by this committee constituted in this way, given the deadlines and the imperatives around Parliament rising. But we would certainly encourage a consideration of that issue, in that there are a range of issues around regulation that have not been tackled as decisively as they might have been. And we would certainly put that recommendation forward.
Discussed, and I mean, if you recall, we was it last year that Parliament discussed the equality legislation because there was a similar process where you have a variety of stakeholders who say certain parts of the legislation it's not functioning optimally, and that we then review the we did review the equality legislation. So I mean, surely that's something we could put in our report.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it shouldn't be in so much in this report,
but
in the general
in our exit report.
Yeah, but Chair, I mean, I think. Through you, also just on the consultation process, I mean, the rules. I mean, what I would have personally, I don't know if it goes to the rest of the things you've expected, is for the draft that you were working on to be made available, circulated to stakeholders with a request for submission, and to consider those submissions. Then when it comes to this process of Parliament, when ODAC come and say we don't agree with A, B, C, and D, you don't have to agree with all the stakeholders, but you need to listen to them and you've got to decide why you don't agree with them. When ODAC or anyone else, Human Rights Commission, comes and says we don't agree with the rules for A, B, C, and D, we can then hear from you why you didn't agree with them. And that's the process. But at the moment, what we seem to be faced with is hearing representations from ODAC that it's not clear whether the rules board considered or not, so they can't respond on what they think. And what is clear, and ODAC may be at fault, maybe they thought, maybe Alison sort of thought about these things in a brainwave a few months ago. We don't know. I mean, we'd have to look at the documents. But the fact, though, is that the documentation wasn't made available. And really, I mean, for a Chapter 9 Human Rights Commission not to be in the loop is really totally unacceptable.
Well, before I give Chairman Chance to respond, just to say that the Human Rights Commission actually phoned me and raised the issue with me and said that they were not in the loop. The documentation wasn't forthcoming. They, in fact, saw it after I informed them that, you know, we are having this process, and we put the notice in the newspaper. So I think one can generally safely say that the consultation was lacking, but clearly not.
Well, I'd say that I think it was because of the time lapse that when the rules board drafted the final draft, it was sent to the Minister for approval without being sent out for consultation, and I think this is something that we will keep in mind in future to make sure that the rules are put onto our website and that interested parties are informed of any changes in the future, because it is a step, even though we were faced with time imperatives, it is a step that we must in the future remember that we must send the rules out for comments.
Okay. Dion,
yep.
Can you respond?
Yeah, just very briefly, Chair. I'm not going to respond in regard to the consultation process of the rules board. When we received the rules, we then, as a department, via the minister, we accept that the consultation has been done. The one point that I would like to make is that the rules that were submitted in 2005, which then appears to me to be the rules that ODAC commented on, those rules never changed, except for a few technical changes that were made as a result of suggestions from the department. And then there was an issue that we debated with the Rules Board, and that took some time. And the issue was whether the rules should also apply to the Constitutional Court. We felt that it should, the Rules Board felt that it should not. Am I correct? Yeah. And that took up some time, and you must also remember that in that, simultaneously with that, the PAJA rules were also received from the Rules Board. And there were a number of concerns which you know about, this committee knows about, the concerns that the department had, and you know about the process that was followed subsequent to the department receiving those rules. And that took up a lot of time. But really the point that I would like to make, and I think Claire must tell me whether she agrees with this, is that the rules that were drafted in 2005 are basically the rules that you have before you now. So if ODAC had the rules in 2005, those are the rules that you're looking at this moment.
Yes, I don't think there were many changes. It was mostly technical changes. There might have been renumbering of paragraphs and that kind of thing, but nothing substantial.
Okay. Way to take the matter forward. I think my sense from, Mr. Jeffries just apologized and had to go to another meeting, but my sense would be from the members at least that we approve the rules, but with a strongly worded report, and that we do not leave it open-ended, but that we ask the Rules Board to consider the comments that were made, the submissions, and that the Rules Board then within a certain period of time report back to the portfolio committee. So if there is agreement, JJ, I was just saying that we approve the rules and that we do a strongly worded report on behalf of the committee, and we give the Rules Board, ask them to come back to us within probably 6 months of the new committee being established this year. Members in agreement, members happy?
Agreed.
Okay, then I'll do the report, I think, tonight. I don't know, and, you know, possibly when we meet then tomorrow, we'll hopefully be ready to put a vote, to put it to a vote. Okay, then,
No, just on the thing, I mean, I presume the department is checking that the NCOP are doing this, because there's no point in us adopting these rules if the NCOP doesn't. I mean, the Act is Parliament. And the NCOP are having their last plenary tomorrow.
Why I was looking at Mr. Reitman with the...
She was used to doing the work of Parliament as well, so it's fine.
I don't think it's the work of Parliament. It's ensuring that the material is brought before Parliament.
I will make a strongly worded report as well. That's just in light of it. I'm sorry that JJ wasn't here when I explained the process that was followed as far as the rules are concerned, the rules that you've now voted on.
No,
but I will inform him after the meeting.
Okay. On the second matter on our agenda, which is the three set of rules drawing from the Shingo case, is the department ready to give just what is the status? Do you want us to proceed with that, or do you first want us to clarify and deal with it possibly tomorrow?
Chair, no, my information now is that it appears that the appeal court rules have been withdrawn. But I don't have anything on record to say that it has been withdrawn. So what you have before you, and I'm very sorry about this, I don't know what the process was and where how that happened. I was not informed, and my colleague was not informed either, as far as we can recollect. So what you have before you then would be the rules of the Magistrates Court, the Magistrates Court Appeal Rules, and the Superior Court, High Court rules, and not the Appeal Court rules. I will try to find out exactly what the situation is. But perhaps Claire must just indicate to us, Chair, that seeing the rules having been withdrawn, where does the Rules Board stand with those rules? Have they been finalized? Because I believe the amendments are just sort of a technical nature.
Yes, it's you mean the Supreme Court of Appeals?
Yes.
Yes. After the Schindler, the Supreme Court of Appeals amendment was actually declared to be unconstitutional in the Schindler case, because the Schindler case, the only amendment to the Supreme Court of Appeals rules was to say that appeals could be heard in chambers, and the Schindler case said that was unconstitutional. So the Supreme Court decided to withdraw it. It sent a memo to the minister that indicating that those rules should no longer table.
The million-dollar question is, Mr. Rudman, will you then just make sure that that it's officially then withdrawn?
We'll do so. I don't know.
I mean, the committee hasn't seen any correspondence to that effect. So, the other million-dollar question is then, do we deal with the rules as a package? In other words, do we proceed today with the magistrate's rules and with the Supreme Court rules, or do we deal with it? Because I understand that the three, on my reading, they're quite. It's pretty much the same sort of.
So what do we have to do with these? I mean,
we have to approve them.
Are you sure?
That is what Christy, I asked Christine to check specifically. Yeah, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, I think it's Section 7, we have to approve.
If we could proceed with them today, I'm sure we'd be able to finalize them.
Sorry?
Maybe we should proceed as a step.
Okay, then we can deal with the Magistrate's Court rules. Remember, it's in this quick bundle mark 07 Magistrate's Court rules. Well, that's my copy. I don't know if I've given other copies to remember it. There are three things all contained in the one bundle.
Supreme Court should be 03.
That should be 03.
And then the withdrawn appellate Supreme Court of Appeal is 02.
Okay, then it should be 03 and 04. Is that correct? Christina, have you got this? This is all in practice. Is it 03 and 04?
I presume the document is 06, which deals with
this,
so it indicates we're talking about 06.
Section 309 of the Criminal Procedure Act, 51 of 1977, read as follows prior to this amendment in 2003. Any person convicted of any offence by any lower court, including a person's discharge of this conviction, may, subject to Section 309B, appeal against such conviction and against any resulting sentence or order to the provincial or local division having jurisdiction. Section 309B of the Act provided that an accused who wished to appeal against any decision or order of a lower court must apply to that court for leave to appeal against a decision or order. On 29th of November 2000, in the case of State versus Stay 2001, Constitutional Court, the Constitutional Court ruled that the words underlined above, subject to Section 309B, are inconsistent with the Constitution and declared them invalid. The Constitutional Court found that the requirement of first seeking leave to appeal before lodging an appeal against conviction or sentence in magistrate court was inconsistent with Section 35.30 of the Constitution. The declaration of invalidity of the subsection was suspended for a period of 6 months from the date of the Constitutional Court order published under Government Notice R1328 in the Government Gazette. The Constitutional Court held further that the petition procedure contained in Section 309C constitutes a limitation of the right of appeal to or review by a higher court, as entrenched in Section 35.30 of the Constitution. The Constitutional Court found that the limitation of rights in Section 309B and 309C was not justified and that these sections were therefore in conflict with the Constitution. The Criminal Procedure Amendment Act 42 of 2003, the Amendment Act, introduced amendments to the Act. Paragraph 210 of the Memorandum of the Object of the Amendment Act states as follows. The main object of the bill is to introduce a shifting mechanism that will prevent the High Court from being overburdened by meritorious appeals from the lower court. The bill attempts to achieve this while taking care to avoid the constitutional pitfalls that invalidated the previous leave to appeal procedure as set out in the judgment of the Constitutional Court in the case of State versus the State. Section 309(1)(a) of the Criminal Procedure Act has been amended by the Amendment Act to provide that a person below the age of 14 years or a person aged between 14 and 16 who is not assisted by a legal representative and who has been sentenced to any form of imprisonment may note an appeal without having to apply for leave to appeal. Section 309B of the Act has been amended to provide that the requirement of applying for leave to appeal does not apply to a person referred to in Section 309(1)(a). That is, a person below the age of 14 years or a person aged between 14 and 16 who was not assisted by a legal representative and who has been sentenced to any form of imprisonment. Amendments to the rules. Section 272B of the Amendment Act provides that the Rules Board for Courts of Law is to revise and when necessary to amend all rules in respect of appeals applicable to the Supreme Court of Appeal, the High Court, and the Magistrate Court in accordance with the provisions of the Amendment Act. Draft rules as required by Section 72B of the Act are circulated to all roles players for comment and further proposals. The comments received were considered at meetings of the High Court Committee and Magistrate Court Committee of the Board and submitted to the full Board at the meeting held on 27th March 2004. The Board approved the rules as amended at the meeting and resolved that the rules were submitted to the Minister for approval and therefore to Parliament in terms of Section 72C of the Act. However, during the process of submission of the draft rules to the previous Minister, certain judges indicated that they wished to comment on the draft again, and it was decided to refer the draft rules back to the Secretary of the Board while awaiting the comments. The judge's comments, mainly aimed at the draft amendments to High Court rules, were submitted to the High Court consideration. The draft rules were again placed before the Board and approved at the meeting held on 8 October 2004. There are a number of general amendments to the rules, just changes to terminology. For example, accused to change the appellant, attorney to legal representative. Attorney General to the Director of Public Prosecutions or person designated by him or her, provincial or local division to High Court, Appellate Division to Supreme Court of Appeal, Chief Justice to the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal. Amendments to the Magistrates Court Rules. Section 302 to 314 of the Act regulates reviews and appeals in cases of criminal proceedings in lower courts. Rule 67 of the Magistrate Court Rules regulates criminal appeals in the Magistrate Court. The following amendments have been proposed to Rule 67. Rule 67.1 presently prescribes the manner in which leave to appeal should be applied for and specifies that the accused is applied in writing to the clerk of the court and shall send a copy to the Attorney General. The proposed amendment states that the accused who applies orally for leave to appeal as provided for in Section 309C need not apply in writing. It refer the proposal to 67 ones in service to the appellant who applies for condemnation or wishes to produce further evidence shall follow the same procedure as set out in Rule 67-1. Rule 67-2 deals with the requirement that the clerk of the court must give at least 10 days' notice of the hearing of the application for leave to appeal. It's proposed that Rule 67-2A, the amendment to specify that the necessity for notice to be given applies where an application for leave to appeal is made in grant seems to differentiate it from the situation in Section 309(b)(3) of the Act, where the accused applies orderly for leave to appeal immediately after the passing of the sentence or order. Rule 67-4 states that the clerk of the court shall write out the notice of appeal when an accused is unable to do so. It is proposed that the rule be amended to also apply to an application for leave to appeal. It is proposed that Rule 5A be inserted to prescribe the procedures to be followed where a person under 14 or between the ages of 14 and 16, as contemplated in Section 309(1A) of the Act, appeals against a conviction or sentence or order. The notice of appeal is to be lodged with the clerk of the court. A copy is to be sent to the director of public prosecutions or to the prosecutor where the prosecution was not in the public instance. The notice of appeal is to set forth clearly and specifically the grounds for appeal. Section 309(b)(2)(b) of the Act originally dealt with the requirement of giving notice on the date fixed for the hearing. After the amendments of the Act, Section 309(b)(2)(d) now deals with it. It is therefore necessary that Form 60, the notice in terms of Section 309(2)(b), be amended. Those are the amendments to the Magistrates Court Rules. The amendments to the High Court Rules. Section 315(3-4) of the Act regulates appeals in criminal proceedings in Superior Court. Rules 49, 51, and 52 of the High Court Rules deal with criminal appeals. It is proposed that the heading to Rule 49 be amended to read civil appeals from the High Court. A heading is to be inserted into Rule 49A, criminal appeals to the full court. Rule 49(1)(a) is to be amended by the insertion of the word if leave to appeal has been, to make provision for the situation where certain persons are exempted from applying for leave to appeal, as in Section 309(1)(a) of the Act. Section 315(a) of the Act has been amended and now provides that appeals must be disposed of in chambers on the written argument of the parties or the legal representatives, unless the judge present is of the opinion that parties should submit oral arguments. It is therefore proposed that Rule 49(8)(2) to 49(8)(7), which deal with setup of hearings for appeals, be deleted. The following rules were also inserted. Rule 49(8)(2)(a), which regulates the delivery of the written arguments within certain time periods. Rule 49(8)(2)(b), which specifies that the written argument should what the written argument should contain. And Rule 49(2)(a), which states that four copies of the written argument shall be filed with the registered clerk. Rule 49(8)(3) regulates the setdown of an appeal for hearing where the judge present requires that the appeal should be set down for oral argument. The proposed Rule 49(4) states that the responsibility of ensuring that all copies of the record are properly before the court rests on the appellant or his attorney. Where the appellant is not represented, the responsibility shall rest on the director of public prosecution. Rule 51 deals with the set-down of appeals from the magistrate court to carry. It is proposed that the rule be amended to make it clear that appeals will not be set out for hearing as a matter of course, but only where the court requires that the parties or their legal representatives submit oral argument support. It is proposed that Rule 51(2), which states that an appeal should be set down to hearing by the register in accordance with directions from the judge present, be deleted. A proviso to Rule 51(3) is proposed to specify that when an appellant is not represented, the ultimate responsibility for ensuring that all copies of the record are before the court shall be on the direct of public prosecution. It is proposed that Rule 51(4), which deals with delivery of our heads of arguments, be deleted, and that Rule 51(4)(a) dealing with delivery of written arguments be inserted. It is proposed that Rule 51(4) be inserted to provide that the provisions of Rule 49(8)(2)(b), which specify that what the written argument should contain, and C, which states that four copies of the written argument should be filed with the register, shall apply misunderstood to the written argument in Rule 51(4)(a). The numbering in Section 309(c) has changed So there's a notice of date fixed for hearing of the petition, which was section 9, is now section 6, subsection 6. Form 25, the notice of the date fixed for hearing is duly and according to this. There were also originally, submission of rules approved by Rules Court. After the Rules Court had approved amendments to the Rules Governing Appeals in accordance with Criminal Procedure Amendments Act on 8th of October 2004, the Secretary submitted the appeal rules to the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor for their scrutiny. The State Law Advisor suggested certain changes which were adopted. The necessary changes are made to the rules and the rules are forwarded to the Minister for approval. On 8th of March 2007, the Constitutional Court in the matter of Shida versus the State confirmed the decision of the NPD that the provisions of Section 309(3)(a) of the Criminal Procedure Act 51 of 1977 were inconsistent with the Constitution and therefore invalid. The court held that it was fundamentally unfair to deny the accused or the prosecution the right to present oral arguments in open court. The court held that oral arguments must be heard in all appeals. The Rules Court therefore removed the reference to disposal of appeals in chambers from the rules regulating the conduct of the proceedings in the High Court. The draft rules were amended in the following respect. In Uniform Rule 49(2)(a), the words after such authorities were deleted. The amendments were basically to remove all reference to appeals being heard in chambers, as this was also the only amendment to the Supreme Court of Appeals rules, so this was no longer necessary. The proposed amendments to the Supreme Court of Appeals rules was declared to be unconstitutional, so that fell away. In terms of Section 6(1) of the Rules Court Act, the Board may make amend or appeal rules to the Supreme Court of Appeal, the High Court, and the Lower Court, subject to the approval of the Minister. The Shinda matter was discussed by the Rules Court at the meeting held on 23rd of June 2007. It was decided that changes to the amendments to appeal rules, which had been submitted to the Minister for approval previously, were necessary in the light of the Shinda matter. The Rules Court sent a memorandum to the Minister on 14th September 2007 commending that the Minister approved the changes to the High Court rules necessitated by the Shinda matter as approved by the Board. It was also recommended that the Minister approve the withdrawal of the amendments to the Supreme Court of Appeal rules as decided by the Rules Court. Section 72C of the Criminal Procedure Act 42 of 2003 provides that the amended rules must be approved by Parliament and therefore be published in the Gazette. Draft rules were sent to the Minister's table in Parliament after her approval.
Okay, maybe just to also make the point that members will recall that we have looked at this previously when we dealt with the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, where we actually amended certain sections of the Criminal Procedure Act. We did look at Shinga and we've made those amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act. It really just is to get the rules in line with Shinga, as we've done with the main act. The only thing I picked up, but I mean, not that it's a problem, but just something that we have to consider in the future, and really just for the Rule Board, is the new proposed 5A of the Magistrates Court Rules, which describes the procedure where a person is under 14 or between 14 and 16. Just to note that in the Child Justice Bill, which we are in the process of passing, we said that children under the age of 16 or between 16 and 18 that have been sentenced to any form of imprisonment would not have to apply for leave to appeal. They would have an automatic appeal. So obviously once the Child Justice Bill becomes an act, then obviously we have to relook at this ruling. So just amend it and look at it again, but for the time being. That's the only thing I picked up from my side. Members, any questions, comments? You, Christy, you just pick it up.
Maybe just...
We also, it's the same thing, we can either approve or reject, so we can't amend.
I think, in general, I think these are quite good rules. It's flowing from a constitutional court judgment, mm-hmm. which dictated that certain things have to change. So it's just putting the rules in line. And then I think our report should really probably be quite a short report to just say that the committee approved. There's nothing else. There hasn't been, it's not the same as the previous one that we want to say anything about the consultation, because I think in this case there has been consultation with the judges, with the magistracy, and also with the state law advisors. Comments have been put forward, they have been effected. So I think the consultation process is slightly different from the previous one. But JJ, and then Claire?
This is again a process question. I mean, the rules were approved October 2004, okay, by the Rules Board and submitted to the Minister. But he doesn't give a date. Shinga was March 2007, and the Rules Board then met again and submitted in September 2007. Why so long?
Well, the way I understood it was that it was actually withdrawn and then resubmitted as well. So maybe just clarify that for the record as well.
Well, the original rules were made in, but they were sent to the minister initially in November 2004. I think they were made in about October 2006. But there was some submissions for amendments to the rules from the department, which were sent back to the rules board to consider. And then when we had sent the rules, when the rules had been, when COVID had been sent to the minister, the Shinga judgment came out. So then we reconsidered the Shinga judgment. That was before the minister had approved the rules. So we asked the minister to consider the amended rules.
I really think the process, I mean, I don't know what quite goes on. I would have thought that I mean, I don't know what public participation is. I mean, presumably all the attorneys and advocates, I don't know if the Law Society, the Bar Council were able to make inputs, whether they were consulted.
Also, just relating to the point that Mama Sean raised earlier, and when I said I think the consultation was better, but I mean, all I know about is that the magistracy and the judges, that they were consulted, but, yeah, Law Society.
Yes, these rules were submitted to all our list of role players. We have a list of role players which consists of the attorneys, the magistrates, all the judges, all the regional heads, basically everyone that has a role to play in the court, the long list of role players that we sent the rules to. So they did give their input and we considered that in drafting the final of the rules.
When was that?
This was before October 2004.
Okay.
Yeah,
because that's when they approved the rules the first time.
Yeah.
But now, why between the Rules Board and the Minister? Surely, I mean, basically the Rules Board have to propose, the Minister then has to agree, so the Minister's effectively got a veto. This process, is it the best process, where you seem to have the Rules Board adopting, then submitting to the Minister, then the Minister says, no, I don't like A, B, and C, and the Rules Board then reconsiders it. Why doesn't the Rules Board send a draft to the Minister? Because I would imagine you would then have to withdraw what you sent to the Minister, and that becomes technically problematic. I also think as far as Parliament is concerned, I mean, I know with money bills, which at the moment we cannot amend, there is an informal process where the draft bill is circulated to the Finance Committee so that they can informally make amendments. Now, as far as Parliament is concerned, why can we not defend the draft and given deadlines by which time we need to come in? So we're not confronted with a situation where we have to accept or reject, or if we don't like, it then has to be withdrawn, and then it takes years. So I really think the whole process of the adoption of rules, particularly, I mean, it's not all rules that require the approval of Parliament, but those that require, I mean, I think generally, the rule, I think all rules are generally rules board to minister. So the advice would be, rather than the rules board formally adopting, informally consult with the minister. I mean, let the rules board say that this is a final draft. We're now sending that final draft to the minister. So they've agreed on the final draft, but it's not adopted by them. They then send it to the minister for comment, and then they can look at what the minister says and then take the final decision, rather than this thing of we've approved, now it's out of our hands, we've sent it to the minister, and then the minister doesn't like it and it comes back to us and it goes on. Then in the case of rules that require the approval of Parliament, the draft should be sent to Parliament before approval by the Rules Board, so that Parliament can make input as well, and it's not then confronted with a situation of it's accept or reject and there's no amendments that can be made.
Yeah, just to say that's obviously supported, because I think any of the problems that we ran into with Fajr in particular could have been averted had all of us, all of them, followed different process. But you know, to get back to the point, Mar, that you raised, I think maybe it would be good to, like you suggested, maybe put it in the report and maybe put it strongly
worded
report.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Claire wanted to respond.
I just wanted to say that the Rules Board and the Ministry have been considering this problem, and we have now since worked out some mechanisms to where the Rules Board has been asked to send their draft at the time we sent out consultation to all the role players, also to the Ministry and the Director General, so that there is discussion at an earlier stage presented later.
Well, then I think can Parliament be included in that? I mean, the difference between Parliament and the Minister, and the difference between those and the other stakeholders is that Parliament and the Minister have been heard. So I would have thought even after the we've taken on board the comments by stakeholders, an informal checking with the people who have veto rights would then be useful.
Okay, so would that then be our recommendation that we approve, or that we put the last part of our discussion in the report? Happy, Dion?
Yeah, asking you to comment. No, I'm quite comfortable with that. In fact, as Claire has said, the process was laborious and it was wrong. And it was very difficult for us also to deal with it. That's why we have these delays of 2 years. Because we get the rules after approval by the Rules Board. Then we need to go through it. We pick up technical issues, other issues that we're not happy with. That then gets sent back to the Rules Board, and not to the Secretariat, but to the Board itself, because they've got to go and look at the rules, and that caused delay. So as Clara said, the previous Minister, and also our new Minister, has now indicated a new process in terms of which the rules will be submitted to the Department before being approved by the Board itself. So we will then have our opportunity or to make an input. And then to respond to what Mr. Jeffries has said, I fully agree. There's no reason why we cannot also then, or the board cannot then also at that stage submit the rules on an informal basis to Parliament, whether it's to Parliament or to the committee, we must decide. Because it'll just have to be informal, where Claire can come and explain the rule, and we can take it from there.
Children under the age of 16, you said that was the proposal in the Policy Act. But this criminal procedure amendment act goes further than that, because it says children under the age of 14, so people misconsider.
Well, the act is being passed tomorrow. I mean, the advantage with it is that it will come into effect in what, the 1st of April 2010. So, you've and the whole aim of giving that long time is to give everybody time to implement. But passed by the NA, passed by the NCOP, back to the NA plenary tomorrow to consider some of the NCOP amendments. You've then got time. I don't know if it's enough time given the amount of time it takes, but you've got basically a year and a half.
Yeah. Okay, so then, we'll hopefully be able to vote on it tomorrow, Lolly, on both.
Where's
the fuel?
Both,
the fire and this one, and both.
We're
going
to
need a
fuel.
Okay,
just to say before that, maybe we're to ask, okay, the Pudger rules, when are we getting them?
The minister made the rules for on the 15th of this month. And what the minister has proposed is that a committee be set up with members of the rules board, members, people from the department, and members of the portfolio committee to discuss the Pudger rules.
Yeah, but when is that happening? Basically, our expectation is we're going to get those rules to adopt in January before before we rise.
Well, the rules board was asked to submit names of two people. I think they have. I don't know when. It's just finalized this week and send those names to the minister, and then the minister will set up the committee. But we'll do this before the end of this week, send the names of the rules board members.
Yeah, I'm really chair before. Okay, Dion.
Chair, my information is that Elton Cheadle is involved in this process. He is going to have discussions with the board. And if I remember correctly, there was a suggestion, I think you said that, Claire, that somebody from Parliament should also be involved in the process. And my information is that this would be finalized by January next year. The time there is just not...
The judicial notice amendment bill, we've only extended the deadline until February next year, so we have to get it done.
My report was the same as Claire's. My worry is, I think the meeting with the minister was 2 weeks ago, weeks ago.
Yeah.
Okay, and we've already lost time. I mean, I don't know if there's a rules board meeting scheduled for early January, mid-January, but there would need to be. And with a judicial matters extension, the department, the ministry had actually only asked for end of November. We, in our magnanimity, gave till end of February, a few more months. Now it doesn't look as though we're going to get it. But basically, look, to you, Claire, I hope things are moving, but we have to pass those rules by in the end of January. Not much is happening in Parliament in February, so there's no time. You would need a rules board meeting to approve those rules by mid-January at the latest. And then they can go to the minister, and the minister can then submit to Parliament. But if you don't follow those time limits, then no Pudger rules.
Okay, then anything else? Just to say that apparently there's a Czech delegation coming, which I think JJ is doing.
No, I was not consulted. I'm not available this afternoon, so I'm not going to be there.
Oh, okay, because I was advised that you were cheering, but be that as it may.
Well, luckily, unfortunately, nobody advised me that I was cheering. I don't think it will be JV either, because JV is at the pardons process. So, you know,
I think you better phone and talk, because I don't know anything about this. I've literally heard about it from Bonani.
I mean, just for the meeting, we've got, I see from the program we're doing the magistrates tomorrow, the disciplinary ones, I see the NCOP has finalized those. We need also to do the judges' salary increases. That has been sent to the Speaker. I presume it's being referred out, but Lolly, please, will you get that thing, and we need to consider it tomorrow. We've then got the reports on here. And then the NCOP is adopting the NPA and the SAFS Amendment Bill tomorrow. I think it would be important for the committees to meet later in the afternoon, because the intention would be to deal with those bills on Thursday, not on Friday. So there would need to be communication with safety and security for a meeting, maybe late afternoon, maybe after. We've got some business in the house tomorrow, but late afternoon for a voting. So we meet in the morning and we take these other votes, and then we meet in the later afternoon on the SAPS and criminal procedure. I mean SAPS and NPA. But delays with safety and security, that it's a joint meeting. Yes, because the desire is to have it on the order paper for Thursday, not on. It was originally Friday was looked at, but the desire is for Thursday. I can explain the reasons outside the meeting. And then.
Yeah, you'll be in the house. I'm asking if you can just come as soon as you can. Then if you're needed, maybe here with us. Thank you.
Just sorry, one other thing on these processing things, I mean, to Dion and to JB, please to make sure the NCOP does everything too. I know they've done the magistrates, because I've seen it on the ACC, but it would be the judge's salaries and these rules. I don't know if they're down. And their last meeting is today, and their plenary last plenary is tomorrow. There's no point in us, with the NA, adopting these rules.
I don't know, Chair. I will do that. I will speak to the Chair. I'm just waiting for him to finish with what he's busy with at the moment. But obviously, they haven't published the way you did, whether it's necessary.
It's not because of her delay.
Okay.
We decided that just, as a token of goodwill and proper consultation, we would publish by the requirement.
All right, but I will try my best for the rules.
Yeah, but I mean, I think with the PIA was to give basically ODAC and other interested parties an opportunity.
Yeah.
Given we can only accept or reject, I mean, I think it was only worth the making it to one of the houses, not both.
Yeah, of course, they've got nothing in front of them at the moment, so we'll have to make copies of all these documents. If we can just get a set of the documents, Charlie, please, so that we can make copies for the NCOP.
I mean, obviously there would be grading. I mean, the magistrate, the judges, what judges or magistrates?
Judges.
The judges' salaries have to be done, otherwise they won't get paid. And the NCOP know about that. So that has to be done. I think the rules then is up to you.
But particularly for it.
But PIA really.
If you don't make it to the magistrate,
people will die.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
people will die.
Yeah. Alison will die. Okay. And you don't want to say that. Oh, yeah, there's a meeting at 1 o'clock about the provincial visits, apparently, but I don't know where.